You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Obama's Asia pivot. As the newly elected US president flies home from a Southeast Asian tour, we ask if Washington's renewed focus on this region comes at the expense of efforts in the Middle East. And as Britain joins the ranks of France in recognising the Syrian opposition coalition, we find out what the chances are of renewed decisive action in the Middle East. Plus, as the rockets continue to fall, we assess Israel's military plans in Gaza.
Israel is not going to remove the Hamas regime from power in Gaza. And once you have troops on the ground, then you have increased civilian casualties.
And as a trade spat between the West and China rumbles on, we find out how Chinese porcelain is suddenly on the European Commission's radar.
China has complained to the World Trade Organization, complained about subsidies of solar panels in the EU. So, you know, there is the makings of a trade war.
And micropayments. Could they be the solution to journalism's financial woes? We'll find out more about that. So lots to come on the next hour here on Midori House. Once again, a very warm welcome to Midori House. Let's start by getting a wrap of the world news. That's with Jonathan Wheatley.
Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi says he expects Israel to end attacks on Gaza shortly. Officials from Hamas and Islamic Jihad said a Gaza ceasefire deal would go into effect within hours, but a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said they were not there yet. Israel says it has put plans for a land invasion of Gaza on hold, but has also told villagers in the Strip to move to central areas for their own safety. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, was deeply concerned about the growing number of casualties. So far, at least 108 Palestinians have been killed. Rupert Colville is her spokesman.
The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, is acutely concerned about Palestinian and Israeli civilians caught up in the ongoing crisis in Gaza and southern Israel. She's dismayed by the marked surge in the number of Palestinian civilians, including women and children, killed and injured over the past 48 hours as a result of Israeli military action. The High Commissioner therefore calls on Israel to scrupulously meet its legal obligations to distinguish at all times between civilians and combatants.
Meanwhile, Palestinian gunmen have shot dead six alleged collaborators in the Gaza Strip who were caught red-handed, according to Hamas Aqsa Radio. The station said the men who were suspected of working for Israel were shot. In Poland, the radical nationalist who planned to blow up parliament did have links to the right-wing extremist who murdered dozens of people in Norway last year. Prosecutors said the suspect planned to plant 4 metric tons of explosives in a vehicle outside parliament and detonate it remotely. According to Rafał Panowski, head of the far-right monitoring group in Poland, the plot had parallels with Anders Behring Breivik, the Norwegian, who set off a bomb in Oslo last year and then went on a gun rampage on a nearby island, killing a total of 77 people.
Well, it seems very clear the ideology is similar in the sense that it is a shared right-wing extremist ideology, which is xenophobic, which is anti-democratic, and also the method of a small group or an individual acting in a very extreme way against the democratic system. Well, this is a very clear similarity here.
Humanitarian workers in Goma, the city seized by rebels today in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, say they were forced to take shelter in a United Nations compound after gunfire ricocheted around compound walls. Fighters from the M23 group entered Goma after days of clashes with UN-backed Congolese soldiers that forced tens of thousands of residents to flee. Here, UBS rogue trader Kweku Adeoboli was given a 7-year jail sentence today after being convicted of 2 counts of fraud, resulting in the Swiss banks losing $2.3 billion. Steve Head is the City of London's chief police detective.
But behind this facade lay a trader who was running completely out of control and exposing UBS, to huge financial risks on a daily basis. Rules put in place to protect the bank's position and the integrity of the markets were being bypassed and broken by a young man who wanted it all and who was not willing to wait.
And finally, a former ice cream parlour owner confessed in court to shooting, sawing up and freezing both her ex-husband and her lover and burying them under the cellar of her store in Vienna. Estebalitz Karanza, dubbed the Ice Lady by Austrian media, told a court that both men had demeaned her, her ex-husband by yelling at her and making fun of her poor German, and her lover by being unfaithful. As Shakespeare would say, hell hath no fury than a woman scorned. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, I'm sure the families of the victims will be reassured by your Shakespeare there. What a shocking story.
Absolutely.
Horrifying.
Absolutely, yeah.
Goodness me. Well, that's something perhaps will make anyone think twice about cheating or demeaning anybody else. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, de London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres. Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 18:07 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London, with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, the US President Barack Obama is spending most of today on Air Force One as he returns from a three-day trip to Asia. He's possibly overflying parts of the Middle East, though he's not scheduled to disembark in that particular region. Instead, his Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been dispatched to try to defuse a week of violence and bloodshed in Gaza. Well, perhaps the highlight of Obama's Asian tour was his stop in the former pariah state of Burma, where he became the first sitting US president to visit that country, all part of his administration's so-called Asia pivot, an attempt to counter Chinese influence in the region. But some political analysts are saying that it's very unlikely that Washington can or will turn its back on the Middle East, and that a focus on Asia could in fact complement rather than come at the expense of a focus on the Middle East. Well, for more, we're joined now by the Financial Times' Jeff Dyer in Washington. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us, Jeff. Your article on this very issue appears in today's Financial Times, and you point out that Asia only got two mentions in Obama's foreign policy debate with Mitt Romney, whilst the Middle East and Asia and Israel, rather, got a combined 59 mentions. So why is it that a newly elected Obama has chosen Asia rather than somewhere in the Middle East for this first big overseas tour?
Well, it's partly coincidence and partly substance. There was a summit scheduled for this week that the U.S. goes to every year, and so then, in fact, the president was always going to be going to Asia this week. But the White House really wanted this to be symbolic as well. They want Asia to be the big focus of the second term of the Obama administration. They want Asia to be the sort of centerpiece of what they're trying to do to reinsert America into the life of Asia and to find ways to address the rise of China. And so they hope that, you know, by making this quite splashy trip image after the election, this would really raise the profile of Asia and the political agenda in the U.S. Of course, at the same time, they found themselves fighting fires again in the Middle East. The president and Hillary Clinton have spent half the time in Asia on the phone to various leaders in the Middle East. So it's in a sense, it is a metaphor for the underlying problem they have. They want to think about Asia, but they keep on getting drawn back into the Middle East.
And of course, Asian headlines, you know, Barack Obama with Aung San Suu Kyi, it's slightly better for media consumption, isn't it? Because after all, where on earth could Barack Obama go to at this precise moment in the Middle East if he was to do anything to be of assistance?
Well, exactly. And in Myanmar, where he was yesterday, is in some senses one of the great success stories of the last few years in terms of American foreign policy. They've been very active in trying to guide the new civilian government towards political reform, towards modernizing its economy. And so the fact that the president went there was a way to sort of underline what they think is one of their big achievements. But as you say, there's not much he could do actually in the Middle East. I mean, all the work he can do is really on the phones. There's nowhere really he could go. Hillary Clinton is going to go arrive later today or tomorrow, but by then it does look as if there'll already be some sort of ceasefire in place, which makes it a bit easier for her to operate.
And some cynics are saying that perhaps Burma or Myanmar is a slightly sort of lower hanging piece of fruit and therefore easier to deliver as a success story to the United States public and also to a global audience when so many, in particular, Middle Eastern issues seem to drag on ad infinitum.
Well, exactly. It's very hard to find that kind of success story. I mean, the one success story they thought they had in the Middle East in terms of the last few years was Libya. And you know, the downfall of Gaddafi and so on and so forth. But that did rather, in terms of the way it perceived here, that backfired very spectacularly with the attack on the consulate in Benghazi and the death of the American ambassador to Libya. So there is no real place they could go to there that makes it seem as if they're, that the Obama administration has achieved something very constructive or very coherent over the last few years. So yes, Asia has much better headlines and much better PR and better photo ops when he goes to Asia than when he goes to the Middle East.
Mm. And in your article, you say that oil is at the very heart of this issue of the Asia pivot. Rather, conversely, Obama and his administration, despite the focus on Asia, is going to find itself, like it or not, drawn back into Middle Eastern affairs. Could you explain how that works?
Well, there is a sort of tantalizing idea in Washington that because the U.S. is buying ever less of its oil from the Middle East, that somehow that will allow it to kind of detach itself a bit, to be less involved in the politics of the region, to have to police its politics a little less. And so there is this sort of idea that over the next 4 years, the U.S. will downgrade the importance it puts in the Middle East and upgrade the importance it places in Asia-Pacific, which is the most dynamic part of the world economy. The problem is, though, that Asia itself is incredibly dependent on oil from the Middle East. China is a huge buyer of Middle East oil, but also America's two key allies in Asia, South Korea and Japan, are big buyers of Asian oil. And then more broadly, the whole Asian manufacturing network that's underpinned globalization over the last couple of decades, that also really depends on Middle East oil. All the, the flat-screen TVs that we might buy that come from Asian factories, they're fed. There's lots of plastics in there that require oil that often comes from the Middle East. So if you're America and you start looking more and more towards Asia as the place where you want to be very active and you want to start organizing things, actually, there's no escaping the fact that Asia is also very dependent on Middle East oil. So you really kind of go around the world the other way, but you end up back at the same questions of having to guarantee supplies and guarantee stability in the Middle East if you want to have a prosperous and stable Asia.
Absolutely, and keeping those key allies, South Korea and Japan, absolutely unhindered in terms of access to the Middle Eastern oil. Do you think it's going to be very hard, though, just broadly looking at Asia, for the United States to suddenly try with a new strategy in the year 2012 to try to counter the world's second largest economy in its very own backyard in terms of influence?
Well, actually, it is rather counterintuitive. I mean, the assumption for the last decade has always been that the stronger China gets, the bigger its economy gets, the more it will draw lots of these Asian countries into its kind of sphere of influence, into its realm. But actually, the opposite is happening. There's a very low amount of trust that these countries have towards China. They don't trust what its intentions are. They don't trust this big investment in the Chinese military. And so they're actually looking much more to the U.S. to come in and provide some kind of assurance and to really balance the growing influence of Chinese power. So rather than squeezing the U.S. out of Asia, actually the rise of China actually makes the U.S. more welcome. And the U.S. is finding lots of doors are open to it that wouldn't have been before. And Burma, Myanmar is one of those examples. And in some ways, what the government there has been doing, embracing political reform, opening up the economy, has been a way to try and get out of a kind of suffocating embrace they felt with the Chinese government next door. They felt they were becoming a client state of China. And so they're looking for other options. And a better relationship with the U.S. is the best way to do that.
Indeed, China may have found it was on the wrong side of history there with regard to Burma as well. Thank you very much indeed, Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times there. In a moment, we'll be hearing how the EU has hiked the customs tariff on Chinese porcelain.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week, we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion, and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we talk the future. We attend the first Fashion Week in Haiti. We look at the changing skyline of Barcelona. And we drop in on Green Build, the sustainable construction trade fair in San Francisco.
If you look at a building where most of the energy is lost, that actually happens at the building facade. The windows are actually a critical point in managing energy efficiency of a building.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, protectionism, currency manipulation, cutthroat prices, worker exploitation and disregard for the environment. Those are just a few of the charges levelled at China by the US, Japan, the European Union and others. And Brussels has just launched its latest counterattack on the world's number two economy with a temporary hike in customs tariffs on Chinese-made porcelain and ceramic tableware from 17.6% to a socking 58.8%. A little earlier on, I spoke to Reuters news agency's Philip Blenkinsop in Brussels. I started by asking him why it was that porcelain and tableware were on the European Commission's radar.
Basically, this followed an investigation which has been running for 9 months now. And investigations are generally launched when the industry, i.e. EU producers, or at least a large part of producers, EU producers, complain. So, The reason that there are duties is essentially because the producers here in the EU have lodged a complaint.
And presumably porcelain and tableware produced in China is not it doesn't represent an insignificant amount of money either, I'd imagine.
No, indeed. The import volume, I think it was in 2011, was 730 million euros, which in pounds is about 600 million pounds. So this is one of the larger cases that the Commission has looked at.
Now, not every European government seems to agree protectionism is necessarily the right way forward for the bloc.
Well, that's quite right. And this case was rather interesting because of the 27 nations, 14 of them, so obviously a majority, actually voted against, which is actually quite unusual because they generally vote, well, the Commission generally imposes measures and the member states generally, or at least the majority of them, generally support them.
But in this case, a majority is against, and yet that temporary hike in tariffs on Chinese-made porcelain and tableware is going to be implemented nonetheless.
That's right. It started immediately. So the investigation then continues for another 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, obviously the Commission can decide, well, we want to impose these measures or keep them, and they would then be definitive and last for five years. But at that point, the member states actually vote, and if they vote against, the Commission actually has to take notice of that and cannot impose measures. So, you know, in the next 6 months, you can imagine, you know, quite a lot of lobbying at the EU. Clearly, it would only take one member state to move the other way, and then you'd have a majority in favour of the measures.
But some European government ministers have been voicing in recent days the idea that Europe's being rather naive when it comes to trade issues, in particular with China. Is that an opinion that's shared quite broadly?
Well, I think you generally have certain blocs within the EU. So the Scandinavian countries are very much pro-free trade. Britain, the Netherlands, for example, tend to go along with them. On the other hand, you have the likes of Spain, Italy, France, who tend to be more in favor of measures. So there is a bit of, you know, what might be called a kind of north-south split.
All right, so if the EU is not entirely united on this issue, if the result is that China, which is, of course, the EU's biggest trade partner, retaliates in some respect, then it seems that all 27 members are going to have to face the consequences.
Well, of course, there is that risk. In a much bigger case, which is solar panels, China has done just that. It's complained to the World Trade Organization, complained about subsidies of solar panels in the EU. So, you know, there is the makings of a trade war. Clearly, people who believe that you know, imposing duties is the right course of action believe that if you continue to let China dominate certain industries, the EU industries or EU producers will be wiped out, and potentially China is then in a position, or at least Chinese producers, then in a position to raise their prices because they don't have any other competition.
And that was Reuters news agency's Philip Blenkinsop in Brussels speaking to me a little earlier on. In a moment, we'll see what business stories have caught the attention of our senior editor Sophie Grove in this month's edition of the Monocle magazine. It is 18:21 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, with the latest edition of Monocle out this week and gracing the shelves of your local bookstores of note, each day this week, we on Midori House will draw your attention to some of the stories focused on in the magazine. Today, our senior editor, Sophie Grove, joins me in the studio with her choice of stories from the business section. Hello, Sophie.
Hello. Lovely to see you.
Very nice to see you, too. We're going to be starting somewhere I have to confess I don't know an awful lot about. Very northerly and very cold.
Very cold indeed. Well, it is interesting that this feature has got quite a lot of breadth. It's really spanning five countries that all share the same region, and that's the top of the world, the Arctic region. And we chose, after much deliberation in the features meetings, to focus on a very small town in the Arctic, Kirkenes in Norway. It's on Norway's really most northern coast, in the county of Finnmark. It's basically one of the most remote settlements in Europe. And it's just a little place. I mean, it's probably about 8,000 people living there. And that's the sort of greater region of Kirkenes. Mm. You know, weatherboard houses, little wooden churches. And it's on the cusp of quite a big change, really, because as the ice shelf melts in the Barents Sea, that's just out of the fjord where this little town is, there's a lot of oil. And that also means that it might be a navigable sea route as well. So there's a lot of possibility there.
And it looks like, looking at the photographs, of which there's quite a number, it looks like a very sort of tight-knit community likely is resident there in Kirkenes. And it does look a little bit bleak, but, you know, as you say, it's got enormous potential, and presumably that's drawing quite a lot of speculative businessmen from different corners of the globe.
It really is. It's fascinating. I mean, at the moment, the Norwegian oil industry is 40 billion. But, you know, they think that there could be, you know, up to 175 to 2.46 billion standard cubic metres of recoverable oil in that region. And you can just imagine the impact that's going to have on a place like this. And it's already feeling it. So there's a whole load of businessmen coming in and out, and there actually isn't the capacity for hotels and housing there. So they're building a lot of houses. Our writer spoke to hotels that it's expanded, you know, fourfold in the last decade, even, you know, just trying to sort of keep up with the amount of businessmen that are just sort of flying in and out. There's also a shipbuilding company there, sort of refitting fishing fleets, and there's a big crab industry, and these giant Arctic crabs that are completely delicious. Mm. And they are a mainstay of the economy too. And so there's a big shipping company called Kimmick, and it's right in the centre of the town, and it's quite interesting to kind of find a city that's still, well, a town rather, that still functions with the you know, this factory in the centre of its heart, which is so rare in the way that we build our cities these days. And everything functions around that, and everything functions around the mines too. Just over the hill, there's a big mine. And so they are really looking at expanding the infrastructure in the whole region, trying to link up rail, freight, trying to get, expand the harbour, increase the depth. The actual plans that are outlined in the piece are so phenomenal. Like, you just really can hardly believe that this little place is going to, cope in terms of its community. So we're looking at that. We're also looking at the fact that this is an incredibly dangerous area of the world for drilling. So many of these guys, especially after the Gulf of Mexico spill in 2010, have had real problems, and really just keeping up with the safety drilling out there. So many plans have been thwarted by the elements. And you have to just look at, what they're doing in Alaska. Shell, for instance, they've been sort of had malfunctioning equipment. Ice has just been hampering their drilling activities, but they are drilling. And so companies, are very, very determined to make these little hubs like Kirkenes into bigger and more sort of meaty industry hubs with all of the infrastructure that comes with it.
It sounds like a sort of little emirate in a way of the north, and it's even got the northern lights that you can see apparently from that particular part of the world, something I've always wanted to go and have a look at. It's going to be an amazing sort of newfound wealth for what's essentially a very small population, as you said, and yet an incredible wealth of resources, not just the oil, presumably with the mining activity just over the hills. There's that as well. This place, could very well, by the looks of things, just very superficially looking at the figures, it could become one of the places with the highest GDP per capita on the planet.
I mean, it could. And it's so interesting to look around the region, Navarik, Nuuk, little places up in Alaska, Unalaska, which is a huge fishing port at the moment, but not so much else going on there, could become really significant. And the brilliant thing about this, we've got lots of maps in the story, which really helps bring this to life, because it's the top of the world, and you have to imagine that. But it's such an incredibly historical sort of conquest, these routes, like the Northern Sea Route. In the 15th century, people were trying to navigate that because they knew that if you didn't have to go all the way around the tip and then more recently through Suez, you could really save in costs. So shipping companies are still, they've got their eye on all of these routes, and somewhere like Kirkenes could be the absolute stop-off for those ships taking cargo, in this absolute epic journey through those straits, and then, from Cathay to the Americas and beyond. I mean, this is the ancient route that was, so mythical, and it's actually happening now. Sadly, global warming is getting going.
It's one of the few, as you say, I suppose you could interpret it as an advantage, a business opportunity at least, being presented by melting ice and global warming. That is a part of the world I knew nothing about, and I now think I think it merits a visit. Those northern lights. Have you ever seen the northern lights?
I've seen a smudge.
I want to see them full on.
I haven't seen them in full flight, that's for sure.
Well, here's someone who might have seen them. Thank you very much indeed, Sophie Grove, our senior editor there. We're going to stay in Scandinavia for a song. Here's Anna Brun with Do You Remember? And 1 minute we were talking about Norway. There we were hearing someone in Norway singing. That was Anna Brun there with Do You Remember? Well, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be hearing how Britain joins the ranks of France in recognising the Syrian opposition coalition. We'll be asking whether micropayments rather than paywalls could be the solution to journalism's financial woes. But here's Jonathan Wheatley first with a wrap of the world news.
Thank you very much. Officials from Hamas and Islamic Jihad say a Gaza ceasefire deal will go into effect within hours, but a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said they were not there yet. Israel says it has put plans for a land invasion of Gaza on hold, but it has also told villagers in the Strip to move to central areas for their own safety. In Poland, the radical nationalist who planned to blow up Parliament did have links to the right-wing extremist who murdered dozens of people in Norway last year. Prosecutors said the suspect planned to plant 4 metric tons of explosives in a vehicle outside Parliament in Warsaw and detonate it remotely. Humanitarian workers in Goma, the city seized by rebels today in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, say they were forced to take shelter in a United Nations compound. Fighters from the M23 group entered Goma after days of clashes with UN-backed Congolese soldiers that forced tens of thousands of residents there to flee. And finally, UBS rogue trader Kweku Adeoboli was given a 7-year jail sentence today here in London after being convicted of 2 counts of fraud, resulting in the Swiss bank losing $2.3 billion. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
$2.3 billion, a huge sum of money to have mislaid there by someone.
Unbelievable.
I think if I lost £2.3, I'd or $2.3, I would probably notice that. Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan Wheatley. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. We're going to turn our attention now to Gaza and Israel, and we understand that a truce could be imminent after 6 days there of hostilities. Well, what was described as a quiet night last night between the two sides became a day where the possibility of an Israeli ground invasion still existed. And all the while, Mohammed Deif, who is the head of Hamas's military wing, speaking on Hamas television a little earlier, said nothing about a ceasefire, although he encouraged his followers to keep on fighting. So where do we go from here? And what's Israel's overall strategy amidst this general violence? Well, Daniela Peled, who is a Monocle contributor and editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, spoke to our very own Robert Bound a little earlier on here in Studio One.
The conflict there is reaching a critical point as it as 1 week of fighting starts to come around. It started off from the Israeli military perspective as a very precise, very successful strike with a very high-profile assassination. And then Israel moved in to take out much of Hamas's long-range missile fire. Also from the Israeli point, their Iron Dome missile interception system has been very, very successful. But now we can see a change in the military strategy. Yesterday there was a Hamas media centre, which was bombed. Today, there was a bank which was accused of channeling funds to Hamas. So these are very much secondary targets. And this would seem to indicate that Israel is running out of high-profile targets that it can hit from the air without incurring mass civilian casualties.
And so these the targeting of a bank and of a media centre, they're good politics in terms of strikes, aren't they? But they, as you say, they're not kind of key. They're not key leaders of Hamas. They're not people in the military wing of Hamas. These are, as you say, secondary targets. Is a ground invasion one of the things? Is that more of an offence in order to knock out premier targets? Is that what that would be for?
Well, the ground invasion is the big threat that Israel still has to hold over Hamas. And they've authorised the call-up of 75,000 soldiers, which is potentially a huge force. Now, the problem is that when you start these military adventures, it's all very well. You can start with some dramatic moves, but then you don't know where they're going to end, especially when it's a situation like this where there isn't a clear-cut military achievement. Israel is not going to remove the Hamas regime from power in Gaza. And once you have troops on the ground, then you have increased civilian casualties. And you have casualties of Israeli soldiers, which isn't going to play well with the civilians back home. Although there's absolutely overwhelming Israeli support for this operation, when it comes to support for a ground invasion, that's only about 30%.
And in terms of overall strategy, Moshe Yalon, who's Israel's deputy prime minister, said, "We don't claim to topple Hamas. This is not our objective. It is to deter them. But if it's not, if that deterrent isn't working, if there's still rockets being fired into Israel, then that's presumably when the ground troops have to start fastening their boots."
Well, it is very true. I mean, they want to regain their strategic deterrence. There's been more or less a livable with a level of quiet from Israel's perspective since Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009. But now Hamas was beginning to participate in the rocket fire itself rather than stepping back and it being down to smaller groups. And I think the analysis was they were emboldened by the Muslim Brotherhood government in Cairo, so thought they could up the ante a bit. But then there's strategic deterrence. There is knocking out, as I said, some of the more long-range missiles. And Israel can't do any more than that without sending troops in. But that also will be not only unpopular at home, but very unpopular abroad. Israel so far has had almost a surprising amount of support from the international community, especially from Obama, who has not always seen eye to eye with the Netanyahu administration.
Well, I was going to talk about that. It seems that Hillary Clinton will be coming to take part in these peace talks. Mohamed Morsi has already kind of tried to do the same. Ban Ki-moon was speaking live an hour ago. So there is obviously there is a rallying of international support. Maybe Ban Ki-moon can't do anything without Obama and Clinton. Is that good news, do we think?
I think it's a party everyone wants to be present at now, but crucially it's the ceasefire talks going on with Egyptian intermediaries which are important. And I would say that the next 24 to 48 hours will be crucial, because if there isn't progress made before then Israel may find itself backed into a ground invasion, although really it's not what the political elite wants, not what the military wants, certainly not what the public wants.
I said in the introduction there that Mohammed Deif, who's the head of Hamas's military wing, was talking on Hamas TV an hour ago, and he seemed to be rallying people rather than talking about the ceasefire that the Israelis are talking about, that the international community is talking about and Ban Ki-moon is trying to encourage. Would Israel react simply to those words, or is it only the rockets? Is it the intent of stirring up violence that can be reacted to, or only physical rockets being rained down upon you?
I don't think rhetoric really comes into it, because whatever happens, and what's sure at the end of this round, that Hamas will claim it as a success and Israel will claim it as a success. Hamas will say, we sent rockets towards Jerusalem, we sent rockets towards Tel Aviv, so we terrified the Israeli public and so on. So rhetoric is something to be put on the side. And there are other messages, I think, coming out from Hamas. Khaled Meshaal yesterday gave a press conference where he didn't sound quite as bombastic and triumphant as he might have done. I mean, it's hard to read between the lines, but certainly Hamas doesn't want a ground invasion and would be quite happy, I think, to have this round finish fairly soon without an escalation. And both sides will retreat, discuss through intermediaries what happens next. I mean, the solution is there's not going to be a solution. There's not going to be any kind of agreement, but there might be a revamped status quo.
Well, it's interesting to say straight away that there won't be any difference in the overall thing. There might be a change, but there might be sort of changes in the subtlety of it. I suppose that's the point that everyone knows they're at when they know that talks will come to nothing, right?
But there's no doubt there is no military solution for this conflict. Not in terms of the occupation of the West Bank, not in terms of the situation in Gaza. No one pretends there's a military solution. The problem is we're very, very far away from anything approaching a political solution. You know, while all this is going on, the PA in the West Bank are preparing to go to the UN on the 29th of November to ask for upgraded status at the UN. I mean, they're progressing towards a perfectly legal, legitimate, non-violent method of resistance and achieving statehood. Well, the Israelis are not parlying with them either. So there isn't a track on the non-violent side, and there isn't a track on the violent side. The best that I think Hamas can hope for after this fighting finishes is that in terms of Gaza, they might have some benefits, increased access from the Egyptian side, increased imports, some certain more freedom of movement. But more than that, nothing is going to be achieved.
And that was Daniela Peled, a Monocle contributor and editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, speaking to Robert Bound a little earlier on. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with more from the Middle East. Britain joining France in recognition of the Syrian opposition.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, and New York.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way. but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
It is 18:41 GMT, 20:41 in Beirut, which is where we're heading to now, because the British Foreign Secretary William Hague announced a short while ago that the UK has decided to recognise Syria's newly formed opposition coalition as the sole representative of the Syrian people. Hague met leaders of the Syrian National Coalition here in London on Friday, and his statement to Parliament today, he said that he had asked the group to appoint a political representative to Britain. Well, to talk us through the significance of this, we're joined by Abigail Fielding-Smith, who's a Beirut-based British journalist who's covering the Syrian conflict from there in neighbouring Lebanon. Welcome to the show, Abigail, and thank you for talking to us. Presumably there are hopes across the border in Syria that this latest coalition will be rather more effective than the last.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's a very unpromising situation wherever you start from with trying to organise and unify the Syrian opposition, but this council has got more different groups under its umbrella than the last attempt managed to, and more crucially, it seems to have a lot more international support than the last attempt at forming an umbrella group had. So although there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic in terms of sort of ongoing fracturedness of the opposition, this seems to be, if there's going to be a way to unite it, this seems more promising than anything else that has come along.
So an organised opposition at last. But what's the response like in Syria itself? I know you're not there, but what are you hearing with regard to how people in Syria, the people there, the citizens of the country, respond to this idea of a group in exile that's representing their interests?
Well, there's a range of reactions. I mean, as always, that there's a sort of feeling that, you know, this is stuff that's been going on outside and in foreign capitals and away from the ground, even though this body has made more efforts to represent people from the ground than the last attempt. So there's a bit of that. I mean, some of the sort of more kind of savvy, politically sort of aware commentators that you see seem to realise that even if it's not perfect and they don't like it, it's probably the best shot they've got at getting more international support. But the real problem is what this group has to do if it's going to have any credibility in the long term is establish some kind of relationship with the armed groups on the ground. And this is where they've run into difficulties. There's been some contradictory statements in the last few days from some of the rebel groups fighting in Aleppo initially. Some of them seem to be saying that they didn't support the coalition. Now another statement has come out today, which seems to show that at least one of the main groups does support the coalition. But, I mean, the problem is that the armed groups on the ground are so disparate, so disunited, and there's so many kind of divisions between them that, and also kind of disorganized amongst themselves. So that, you know, trying to organise and unify, let alone provide leadership for these groups, is going to be the biggest challenge, I think, facing this body in the coming months.
Well, as that body was being formed in Qatar a couple of weekends ago, one of the big things we were hearing is that the rebels on the ground felt very unrepresented by what was going on there in Doha. But do you think that it's possible for a coalition or an opposition like this in exile to really do very much to coordinate what's happening on the ground?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to be very difficult. I mean, I think the idea is that eventually they would start to base themselves somewhere in northern Syria, I guess, or, you know, and would try and sort of work on having closer relationships with people on the ground. But, I mean, in a way, the problem is that we're not even at the stage where we can start to worry about that yet. First, we've got to worry about the fact that, you know, how do you go about building relationships with the people on the ground when they're so kind of disparate and so difficult to get them all under one umbrella. I mean, the most likely way that they would be able to do that would be if they were able to kind of funnel new supplies of money and weapons to these groups, then people would be more inclined to listen to them. And it's not clear yet if that's going to happen or if, you know, new international efforts to support the opposition will in fact be channeled through that group, although the sort of spate of international recognitions we've seen in the last few days is obviously, you know, going to be giving some people in the body hope that that will be coming.
Mm. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed, Abigail Fielding-Smith, a Beirut-based British journalist covering all the events across the border there in Syria. Well, we're going to stay in Abigail's territory because we're going to have a song now. This is Tawfiq Farouk with Ya Habibi. That was the Lebanese composer Tawfiq Farouk with Ya Habibi. Habibi, of course, being a very important word if you are planning to visit the Middle East. It means my darling. So something you perhaps want to use liberally when you're visiting that part of the world. You're listening to Midori House. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, as any journalist will tell you, a considerable amount of effort and research goes into crafting a decent article. So it's no surprise that a growing number of newspapers and journals require you to part with money if you're to read their content online. Well, until now, the tendency has been for you to be able to read a few sentences of the first paragraph, and if you want more, you subscribe. But there could be a new approach to paying for high-quality journalism, and it's called micro-paywalls. Well, to tell us more about it, we're joined by Charlie Beckett, who's the director of the journalism and society think tank Polis at the London School of Economics, Media and Communications Department. Charlie, thank you very much indeed for talking to Monocle. Could you tell us what a micro-paywall is, and will it work to pay journalists for their efforts?
Well, I think journalists should be paid, otherwise they will tend not to work. So I think it's a good idea to try and find revenue for the kind of journalism that people might value. The problem has been that as soon as you stick a bit of content online, then it effectively escapes from your grasp and can be, you know, aggregated by people like Reddit and so on, and indeed Google can put it on Google News without having to pay for it. And this has been around for a while, that we've been trying to find a way of, a bit like when you used to throw 50p at the news agent and you'd get a newspaper, we're trying to find an online way of you clicking on an article that you want to read and automatically paying. The trouble is twofold, really. Firstly, it's a bit clunky. That to do it honestly, you have to tell people, and that takes a few seconds, and people don't like doing that. But the much bigger problem is that people don't necessarily want to pay for news if they've got the alternative of not paying for it.
Mm. But as the name implies, micro paywalls, there's not a huge sum of money involved, is there?
Well, there's a difference between, there's paywalls, which is something like the Times newspaper, which has surrounded itself with a paywall. You have to get a subscription and then you can get the whole thing. And there are part versions of paywalls, such as the FT, where you get some of it for free. But the more you pay, the more you get. And then there's micro payments, which are something like, you know, it could be 5p when you just click on a particular article. And the key to this, of course, is not the actual news organization, be it, you know, the FT or the Sun or whatever. It's Google and PayPal. It's organizations like that who actually run, if you like, in effect, the internet, or certainly the bit that where you search for journalism. And so they, you know, we have the technology. They can do it. It's just that in practice, it works for things like iTunes for music. It even sometimes works for sort of film and so on, but it has never been shown really to work for news.
Mm. And do you think there's a way that we could make this catch on somehow? Is it all about the approach, do you think?
My gut feeling, I mean, I'm very open to the idea of it working, but my gut feeling is that it won't, that it's it's doomed. I think it is a bit of a dead end, a bit of technology, if you like. And that's because, you know, there's a couple of reasons. One is the kind of nickel and dime thing. You know, there's a phrase in America, don't nickel and dime me. Don't keep asking me for little bits of money. It's really irritating. I would rather give you 100 quid and just be able to look at what I want. But as I say, that's particularly hard with journalism. In the past, journalism always came bundled up. You didn't pay for the full cost of a newspaper. Advertising subsidized it. You didn't actually want to just read the news. You also wanted to read the sport or the cookery or the comic strips in a newspaper. And so journalism, or news especially, has always been cross-subsidized by kind of wider writing and even things like classified. You'd buy your local newspaper to look through the classified ads. Unfortunately, they're not in the newspaper anymore. They're online.
Mm, and it seems an increasing number of newsrooms in pretty much every medium you can think of are downsizing. So some solution better be found for how this problem is going to be tackled.
Yes, please. You know, answers on a postcard to either me or Rupert Murdoch, and you'll make a fortune. I think it's, in a sense, it's worse than you think, because I think there are just far too many journalists who are creating similar bits of journalism. If you can find a way of creating journalism that's different, that's got added value. It might be that you've got a specialism, or that you're particularly entertaining, or that you're particularly fast, or you've got a particularly groovy platform, then you may be able to find ways of monetizing that. But a lot of journalism in the past has in effect been quite repetitious, and the internet, I'm afraid, just cuts right through that. On the other hand, we've got some fantastic media brands around the world. Think of the New York Times. In Britain, you think of The Sun. They still have tremendous audience recognition. They get a lot of attention. They still drive the agenda. And they're not broke yet. There's still time for them to find new and clever ways to monetize what they do.
And I suppose newspaper and magazine owners can't have their cake and eat it, because the internet is a vital tool nowadays for journalists. It's extremely useful to have at your fingertips all sorts of sources from all sorts of corners of the globe. And on the whole, that's free for us to access as well. So in a sense, we journalists are benefiting from the existence of the internet. It's just that we perhaps would rather like that our articles weren't posted anywhere for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I spent most of my time here at the LSE researching how journalism has been transformed by the internet. I mean, it is amazing that, you know, I can publish something within a few minutes now that can be seen around the world. And I can alert a vast network of people through, for example, Twitter to what I'm doing. And I can connect into. Now, this is clever if you're trying to find your audience. In the past, I might make a very specialized documentary, went out at 2 in the morning on Channel 4, and nobody saw the thing. Now, I can find my audience by making it available with tags and so on, so I can perhaps find that specialist audience. They might value it, and they might pay for it.
Mm. So it sounds like newspapers better get in line and start thinking of some rather clever techniques how to get the audience to pay for what is essentially the hard work and the labours of journalists like us. Well, thank you very much indeed, Charlie Beckett, Director of Journalism and the Society think tank Polis at the London School of Economics, Media and Communications Department. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, it is fast approaching the top of the hour, which means I'm afraid that's all we have time for in today's Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Alan John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald. He'll be telling us about Haiti's first ever fashion week, the future of Barcelona's city skyline, and the annual Green Build Expo in San Francisco.
If you look at a building where most of the energy is lost, that actually happens at the building facade. The windows are actually a critical point in managing energy efficiency of a building.
And in a little over 3 hours from now at 2200 London time, Tamsin Smith and I will be back for the Monocle Daily. Nancy Durham will be here with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, thank you for listening. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24.